Welcome to Background Reefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with a real maverick Republican senator, Senator Lincoln Chafee, who served in the United States Senate as a Republican senator from Rhode Island from 1999 to 2007. He was the only Republican in the Senate to have voted against the war resolution in Iraq, and he's the author of a new book, Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President. So we'll be talking to Lincoln Chafee, getting a behind-the-scenes look at what it was like to be member of that endangered species, the moderate Republicans, inside this radical right-wing regime. And in his book, Lincoln Chafee sounds the wake-up call to all Americans by challenging our government to strive, as Abraham Lincoln once articulated, to elevate the condition of men. Then we'll be joined by Eric Schlosser, who's one of America's great investigative journalists, winner of numerous awards. Eric Schlosser is currently a correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. His first book, Fast Food Nation, is widely considered a modern classic, and we'll be talking to him about a recent op-ed he wrote in the New York Times entitled Burger with a Side of Spies, which is an examination of corporate spying in the United States on American citizens. And then we'll talk with Ian Williams, who writes for The Nation and for The Tribune and for The Guardian of London. He's written a book, including a number of books, including The United Nations for Beginners, and he's been the UN correspondent for The Nation for some time. We're talking to him about the responsibility to protect resolution, which was passed in 2005, and the extent to which many are talking about using that resolution as a way as a non-consensual intervention, if you will, in Myanmar, Burma, where the military regime is refusing humanitarian help from the rest of the world. I'm now speaking with Senator Lincoln Chafee, who served in the United States Senate as a Republican senator from Rhode Island from 1999 to 2007. And let me just quickly give a list here of why Senator Chafee, you were referred to as the real maverick. As a political iconoclast, Lincoln Chafee was the only Republican senator to have expressed support for same-sex marriage, the only Republican to vote in favor of reinstating the top federal tax rate on upper-income payers, the only Republican in the Senate to have voted against authorization of the use of force in Iraq, the only Republican to vote for the Levin Reid Amendment calling for a non-binding timetable for a withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq, and the only Republican to vote against Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito. And of course, Senator Chafee, we're now in the middle of an election year, and a firestorm is being created by President Bush making statements before the Israeli Knesset, which many people consider to be inflammatory and highly political. What was your reaction to that notion the conflation of Neville Chamberlain's holding up a piece of paper back in 1938 and the allusion to Senator Obama?
Well, the beat goes on with President Bush, and I guess who pays any attention anymore to him? I mean, more failed policies. And I guess the key question that crossed my mind was, would you call Richard Nixon an appeaser for speaking with Mao Zedong? And would you call President Reagan an appeaser for speaking with Mikhail Gorbachev? I mean, the Cold War lessons are that if you talk, and I guess Winston Churchill was the one that said, jaw, 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 not war, war, war. And that's what we learned from the Cold War.
Well, of course, yes. The obvious thing is that you make peace with your enemies, not with your friends. And I imagine a necessary step to making peace is talking.
Yes, and we're at that sole superpower status after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the breakup of the Soviet Union. We should have a lot of confidence in his Governor Bush, the candidate, promised to be humble, and he's just been the opposite as president.
And in your new book, Senator Chafee, Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President, you speak about that particular meeting that took place where we President Bush ran, as you just mentioned, on the notion of having a humble foreign policy and as very much as a centrist. Yet on Wednesday, this December the 13th in 2000, you and four of your colleagues in the moderate Republican caucus, if you will, Senator Specter, Olympia Snowe, Susan Collins, and Jim Jeffords, met with Vice President Cheney. Give us a sense of the, obviously you were disillusioned, but briefly, what happened at that meeting?
It was just the six of us, the new vice president, who had been minted just hours earlier by a 5-4 vote of the Supreme Court. We met on a Wednesday, and the Supreme Court had ruled 5-4 that Tuesday night, and he kept his lunch date with us. And it was just the six of us at the lunch table, and I was just shocked that he laid out an arrogant and divisive agenda at that lunch, because they'd promised the opposite. And in fact, the American people had thrown out a number of Republican incumbents in the Senate. Rod Graham's lost in Minnesota, Spencer Abraham lost in Michigan, Slade Gordon lost in the state of Washington, Bill Roth lost in Delaware, a powerful chairman of the Finance Committee lost an incumbent. John Ashcroft lost in
Missouri
to the deceased Governor Carnahan. So that was very significant. The people, American people, had spoken, throwing out all these incumbents, and they had warmed to the message of a humble foreign policy and unity. And here was coming something completely different. And so I was shocked that he would say that, being only the vice president. This wasn't coming from the president. I said, how do you have the authority as the vice president? To myself, I'm thinking. And then I was shocked that my colleagues didn't push back harder at that lunch. Say, with all due respect, we can't agree to this agenda. And with a 50-50 Senate, you're not going to get it without our votes. I was kind of the only one that raised that. And I was the junior member, so I spoke last, even in a lunch, an informal lunch. We go by seniority. And I said, you're going to need our votes, and he couldn't have cared less. We're going to get the votes, is his attitude. Very, very arrogant.
Well, of course, the irony was that I don't know whether it was a direct result of this meeting, but Senator Jeffords switched sides and therefore gave the Democrats the majority in the Senate. And it seems to be that has been the pattern of this regime that we've had, the Bush-Cheney regime, the extent to which they've been bellicose, they've unleashed American power on the world, but it's all so clearly backfired.
Yes, and yet they still seem to think everything's going according to plan. That's what mystifies so many Americans. There's no introspection at all, and after losing that congressional seat in Mississippi, you'd think there'd be some introspection at the top levels of the executive branch. But it's the system set up so that Congress should check and a rogue executive, check and balance a rogue executive. That's what the founding fathers had in mind, and we're way overdue for that to happen.
Well, the other thing that I think is extraordinary, I mean, in the list that I mentioned of the votes that you took, which definitely give you the authentic label of being a Republican maverick, the critical resolution to go to war, it's the vote that Senator Kerry took, that Senator Clinton took, Senator Edwards took, have to some extent haunted them. But I've spoken a number of times to Senator Graham, who was the chair of the Intelligence Committee. And first of all, the Bush administration were prepared to go to war without a national intelligence estimate. And it was only Senator Graham's intervention that got the NIE in the works. And yet, within the committee, the Intelligence Committee, three of the Democrats voted for that resolution. And you could argue that they should have known better, but that's Feinstein and Edwards and Rockefeller. But the rest of the Senate, what did you get that to work on to make that decision? And, of course, you alone among the Republicans made what I think most people would consider in retrospect the correct decision.
I actually took Ian a special trip to the CIA out in Langley, Virginia, on my own. I initiated on my own and went out to them and said, show me everything you have. I have to vote on this. And there were about 20 analysts around a table and just me alone, no staff or anything. And there was nothing there. There were a couple of satellite pictures, an aluminum tube that they said might be used to centrifuge uranium. It was not convincing. The analysts themselves didn't make a compelling case at all. And I was more convinced than ever that there's another agenda, that this is, as Andy Card later said, how we were going to market this. And that just infuriated me, because I thought, if we're going to spread democracy in the Middle East or have some other agenda, let's have that debate. And that might be worthwhile. Remake the Middle East, let's have that debate. But let's not fool the American people with false accusations that Saddam Hussein's a threat to the United States of America. It couldn't be farther from the truth. And, of course, I don't serve on the Intelligence Committee, but Hal Feinstein and Edwards and Rockefeller could vote in favor of the wars. It's just unconscionable.
Well, I remember having a conversation with Senator Kerry in October, just before that vote in 2002, and I guess his feeling was that if he took the vote, he wouldn't win in the South. And guess what? He didn't win in the South, you know. And it turned out his only strategy would have been to have won in the North at any rate. So
well, there you have it. There's somebody admitting that they were doing a personal calculation at the expense of our country. And to then to have the gall to say he should be president of the United States after making that personal calculation is just beyond fathomable to me.
So what happened there, though, in this critical moment where you have a reckless, impulsive president, and as far as one can tell, he was influenced largely by the neoconservative input, the notion perhaps that his father, he was cleaning up his father's unfinished business. And I mean, you can only speculate because, frankly, the President of the United States has never really explained why he went to war, has he? Have you ever heard anything that's consistent and compelling?
No, I have not.
So what happened to our democracy in that moment? I mean, the reason we have a loyal opposition is to stop a government from doing something foolish, surely.
Particularly the Senate, which has a 6-year term, and the Founding Fathers clearly foresaw emotional moments in times such as September 11th, and so they set up the Senate with 6-year terms with only a third of us up at any given time, and two-thirds of us not up. And yet the system didn't work. The people in the system didn't exercise their judgment. As to what it was all about, I think it's a variety. The Iraq War, what was it really all about? As you said, the president has been completely inconsistent and uncompelling in his explanations. But in my next-to-last chapter, chapter 18 in the book, I try and give some insight as to particularly Paul Wolfowitz's testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and where I asked him, right at the mission accomplished, in the early days when things were going well, May of 2003, we've thrown a rock into the pool that is the Middle East, I asked him. What are the ripples that are going out from this a rock that we've just thrown into the Middle East, the ripples in the pond? And he was very forthcoming, and he made some sense. But I don't think the administration shared his thoughts, as I describe in Chapter 18 of my book.
And in your book,
even he was misled to some extent.
And in your book, Senator Chafee, Against the Tide, How Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President, you mentioned that Wolfowitz wanted to tie whatever victory, which was obviously a quick victory, was soon to be followed by a slow defeat. But nevertheless, at that point, it was fairly euphoric. And he was tying in the Palestinian issue. Here we have an administration finally getting around to it in the last year. I mean, do you think, given what happened with Bill Clinton, how he tried so much at the last minute, are they fooling themselves? Or I mean, do you think there's a snowball's chance here of something coming out of this last-minute rush in an area that has been so neglected that it's gotten so much worse?
Yes, and in that question there, I asked Paul Wolfowitz about throwing the rock into the pool that's the Middle East. The very first words out of his mouth when I gave him this broad canvas which to paint a picture were, it's going to help us with the Palestinian-Israeli peace process. Those were his first words. And then he went on to describe in detail how that would happen. And I myself don't believe the president ever was committed. And he keeps saying it. But he's been saying it for years now. And anybody that can face the American people and say, I'm united, not a divider, and then his first act is an abortion act, and to say, I'll have a humble foreign policy, and then get out of all our international agreements, that can say that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, look the American people in the eye, and say these falsehoods, is entirely capable of looking the American people and the people of the world in the eye and saying, I'm committed to peace between the Israelis and Palestinians. It's just not true, in my view. He has no intention of following through. I was chairman of the Middle East subcommittee on the Foreign Relations Committee, so I was very, very closely vigilant on watching these peace processes. And there's missed opportunity after missed opportunity. The death of Yasser Arafat led to the election of Abu Mazen by 60% on a platform of peace, and we do nothing to empower him. In the next election, Hamas wins. I mean, I've watched it unfold and come to the sad conclusion that just like WMD, the president is misleading us and misleading the world on this important issue.
But Senator Chafee, there's no accountability in terms of the president, in terms of the vice president, in terms of Secretary Rice. And I guess this must come from some kind of torpor on the part of the American people, because I understand in this country that people expect results. They honor and competence. I mean, in corporate America, if you ran the United States Inc. as poorly as this group has done, the board of directors would have been tossed out long ago. I mean, we've lost a war in Iraq. We're in the process, many feel, of losing a war in Afghanistan. There is nothing in their record to show anything except catastrophe.
Yes, and now in the subject of Israeli-Palestinian peace, another catastrophe. I mean, so important to our efforts in the Middle East, throughout the Middle East, to have some progress. Nobody's asking for miracles, but show some progress. Just complete catastrophe there. So it's everywhere. And I will say on Paul Wolfowitz's testimony, I think anybody that wants to read that part in the book, they'll be really fascinated by what he said, because it made a lot of sense, the way he described what's going to happen and how this peace is going to be achieved. But don't forget also that the Republicans are losing these seats, and they're eventually going to have to change the way they set up their agenda. I mean, losing that seat in Mississippi was very, very significant. If the Republicans can't win a House seat in Mississippi, they're in big, big trouble.
But in terms of the Middle East, surely one of the problems here is that Wolfowitz, who many people are actually on the left in this country vilify as a kind of uber neocon, if you will, a more nuanced policy is often difficult, because it seems that the AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, essentially carries water from the right-wing Likud, even though most American Jews are on the liberal side. Those that speak for them are on the hard right. And I know that you're now involved with J Street, which is an attempt to find an alternative. In your election defeat, because I met with Senator Whitehouse, when he was running, he was heavily supported by AIPAC. Did that have anything to do with your defeat? Were you on their hit list?
Oh yes.
You were.
Why
were they against you?
I wasn't 100% consistent in voting on the AIPAC agenda. I voted for the Syrian Accountability Act. Won about four or five senators to vote for the Syrian Accountability Act and other such deviations from the agenda, but. I always tried to keep good relations with AIPAC. I met with them at probably monthly in my office, and it gave them my points of view on that I didn't think this was working for the security of Israel, and that we had just different points about how we go about ensuring long-term security of the state of Israel. And they had a different point of view and came after me in the campaign. But as to Wolfowitz, yes, I know he's vilified as an uber neocon, as you said, but it's really fascinating how he answered that question. Mm-hmm. Really fascinating, and I think it might vindicate him in the eyes of some on the far left if they read that answer as to, we've thrown a rock into the pool that is the Middle East. What are the ripples going out? And at that moment of mission accomplished in May of 2003, he gave a broad view of how it's going to work, and big part of it was peace between the Palestinians and Israelis, which reverberates throughout the Middle East. A real Palestinian state living side by side in peace with Israel. And so, in my view, Wolfowitz is not as the top villain that many others feel he is.
What do you make, though, Senator Chafee, of President Bush in this, in the extent to which he seems to be doing this, and perhaps more as a favor to Secretary Rice than anybody else? He seems so detached. And I've talked to some people who know him and said that the getting reelected in 2004, which in a sense was proving to his father that he could do better, since his father was a one-term president. And it's as though after he'd proven that point, if indeed I'm not being too Oedipal here, having proven the point that he'd succeeded where his father had failed, it's as though he had nothing more to do. You know, even though he said, "I've got political capital to spend," frankly, what are the achievements of this administration, this two-term president?
They're precious few because he won't compromise. I mean, he came in after winning re-election, immediately took on Social Security, which we should have done something with, but he wouldn't compromise from his privatization. There were some good plans to make Social Security solvent. The Posen plan was a good plan, a little bit of compromise, and we could have done some great things on Social Security. But no, they're rigid and uncompromising, and nothing gets done.
Except the bankruptcy bill,
right? It's a tragedy, in my view, and I think shared by many Americans.
Well, I can only name the bankruptcy bill. I think it's about one of the only things. Perhaps there's something else that they've passed, but it's been extraordinary given all of the noise. But where it really counts, there's very little to show. What do you think is the real?
That's where the Republican House and Senate too.
Right. So, given the inordinate influence of Dick Cheney, many people who've known him over the years, and people like Brent Scowcroft, say they don't recognize the man today. Since he had such a large part in orchestrating this last 7 years, what do you think is his real agenda? Given that I don't know. I mean, who are the winners in Iraq? I can only see losers. People point to Halliburton and Exxon having won this thing, but I'm curious to get a sense of what you think makes this man tick, and whether he doesn't appear to care what any people think about him. Perhaps
yes, very, very arrogant man. Also has a tinge of anger in him. There's something angry about that man, and it manifests itself in this belligerent approach. I think I absolutely agree with you. A very, very powerful figure in the administration and one of the most powerful vice presidents ever, if not the most powerful, taking advantage of the laziness of the president that really doesn't care about a lot of these issues and manipulates very, very successfully the government. And I'd have to say I read some of these conspiracy type of ideas about it's all about oil and for the vice president, probably a big factor in making sure the Chinese and the Russians don't control the oil, or that Saddam Hussein didn't change into euros, get it off the dollar. I don't understand all the nuances of it all, but probably a big factor. Instead of the smart thing would have been, we should have addressed our consumption. That would have been a whole lot easier than getting ourselves in a quagmire in Iraq.
Right. Well, he dissed that as personal virtue, the notion of consumption. But just in closing, Senator Chafee, obviously the tragic legacy of this regime will be the extent to which they have empowered the really bad people. I mean, they speak about evil all the time, but the truth of the matter is that the Mugabe regime, the generals in Burma, the Chinese hardliners, they all take comfort from the fact that now America has lost the moral high ground because of Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and torture, and Iraq has given America intervention a bad name, if you will. And here we are talking about the UN intervening in Myanmar, this responsibility to protect resolution that UN passed in 2005 being invoked. I mean, to me, that's the great tragedy, that that for all of their talk, their patriotic talk about being righteous and spreading freedom, it seems to me at the end of the day, they've empowered dictators.
I couldn't agree more. And they tell me that on the day of September 11th, or the day after, one of the biggest demonstrations, pro-American demonstrations, was in Tehran. And what do? First thing comes out of the president's mouth is axis of evil, including Iran. And that was the end of that pro-American movement in Tehran. And also, I firmly believe it was the president and our actions, as him as the president, that led to the election of Hamas. The Palestinian people were at wits' ends. They've already voted for Abu Mazen by 60%, and nothing had happened. So they turned to the hardliners. But I will say, all around the world, whether it's Europe or South America or around the world, Asia, people are saying that's not the real America, and that's why this 2008 election is so important. All around the world, people are saying, we want the real America to emerge, and it's a key moment in our history.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Senator Chafee, and for your new book, Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President.
Thank you, Ann.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Senator Lincoln Chafee, who served in the United States Senate as a Republican senator from Rhode Island from 1999 to 2007. And he's author of this new book, Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President. I'm now speaking with Eric Schlosser, who is one of America's great investigative muckraking journalists. He's a winner of numerous awards, and he's currently a correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. His first book, Fast Food Nation, was widely considered a modern classic, was on the New York Times bestseller list for over a year. His other books include Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market, Chew on This, Everything You Don't Want to Know About Fast Food, co-authored with Charles Wilson, and Americans. He's recently testified before Congress about the corporate harassment of farm workers and their advocates. And on May the 7th, Eric Schlosser had an op-ed published in the New York Times entitled Burger with a Side of Fries and Spies, I should say. Burger with a Side of Spies, I should say. It comes as a surprise, I imagine, to most Americans who are aware of the extent to which their government has been eavesdropping on them in terms of the Patriot Act and the secret regimes that we still don't know about. But corporate spying on citizens is something of a surprise. How pervasive is it, do you think, Eric Schlosser?
Well, I think it's very pervasive. In just the last year alone, Hewlett-Packard got caught trying to spy on journalists and actually infiltrate the Wall Street Journal, not exactly a left-wing magazine there, to spy on them. Walmart had to apologize to the New York Times for tape recording a reporter in ways that were underhanded. And now Burger King Corporation was caught being involved with this private investigation agency that tried to infiltrate a student farm worker group, a group of idealistic college kids, nonviolent, inspired by Martin Luther King, who were trying to help farm workers. So in the last year, we've had three major companies caught. And if three are caught, how many are engaged in this kind of surveillance and infiltration and never getting caught? I think it's probably a very large number.
And does this in any way tie into this new phenomenon? We've heard a lot about Halliburton and the extent to which there's been this outsourcing and contracting in the national security arena, particularly in Iraq. Very little attention is paid to how much outsourcing and contracting goes on in the intelligence world, but I understand it's quite massive.
Well, there is a huge and growing private security industry. In the Burger King case that I read about for the New York Times, they were, you know, I think relying on a local fly-by-night Florida private investigation firm. But it's remarkable how many former CIA and FBI and Secret Service agents are now entering the private sector to do this sort of work for big companies. Mother Jones had a terrific investigative piece last month that talked about mainstream environmental groups like Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth, the Center for Food Safety, that were being spied upon by this sort of private security agency, and people pretending to be activists and pretending to be concerned about environmental issues, you know, sitting in on their meetings, taking extensive notes, and providing corporations with, you know, very detailed accounts of what these environmental groups are planning to do. It used to be, if you criticized the government, you had to worry about being spied on or having your phone tapped. And now it's people who are criticizing big companies that are finding that they're being spied on, and that their citizens' groups are being infiltrated. And I find it completely anti-democratic and unacceptable.
Well, there was recently a New York Times expose on a 22-year-old Floridian of Russian parentage, people who'd basically given a lot of money to the Florida Republican Party. And this 22-year-old kid with no prior experience ends up getting a $350 million contract with the Pentagon to sell substandard ammunition. And it sort of echoes a bit with the piece that you wrote in the New York Times, where this Kara Schaefer, 25-year-old woman with no background, starts a company called Diplomatic Tactical Services. One of her subcontractors, Guillermo Zaragoza, is now facing murder charges for executing four crew members of a charter fishing boat, then dumping their bodies at sea. I guess, is this, I mean, without being too facetious, is this only in George Bush's America can you get a government contract and be that dubious?
Well, you know, it's George Bush's America, but I think the problem has more to do with corporate power, and this is an international phenomenon. Again, another fast food chain, McDonald's, in the 1980s, used corporate spies to infiltrate London Greenpeace. London Greenpeace had put out some pamphlets criticizing McDonald's, and McDonald's response was to hire corporate spies to infiltrate London Greenpeace. At some of the meetings of London Greenpeace in London, there were more corporate spies than there were actual Greenpeace members, and McDonald's spied on them for about a year or so. McDonald's sued Greenpeace for libel and spied on them while they were preparing their defense. One of McDonald's corporate spies slept with a Greenpeace activist for months while collecting information on him, and that was in the United Kingdom. I think when you look at these companies, they have annual revenues that are larger than the budgets of many American states. I mean, the annual revenues of Walmart last year were about $375 billion, and a good-sized state like Minnesota has a state budget of about $34 billion. ExxonMobil's profits last year were about $40 billion. That's larger than the total state budget of a very large and important American state. So these companies are huge. They have enormous amount of power. They don't like to be criticized. And when people criticize them, they take action to silence their critics, or at least investigate them so that they can be neutralized. I mean, Michael Clayton, the film, was about this. And you know, we haven't gotten to the point where critics of a company have to deal with car bombs or assassination like in Michael Clayton, but the psychology, the corporate psychology that film depicted, I think is exactly right on the mark.
No, indeed. That was one of the most powerful scenes, I think, the execution of the errant lawyer who was having a nervous breakdown, and the way in which it was done clearly by people out of the intelligence world. Was incredibly chilling. I think it went over a lot of people's heads, but in the sense that what is particularly scary about corporate spying is that, unlike the government, which has managed to particularly this particular regime has managed to thwart as much transparency as they can, in the corporate world, because of the corporate veil or proprietary information, all kinds of stuff is being covered up. I again, referring to the New York Times, they did a piece recently on a guy that died, an immigrant who died in a private prison through neglect. And it turned out that this whole case was covered up under the rubric of corporate proprietary information.
Well, I've been working for years on a book on prisons in America, and I've looked into the private prison industry, and it's remarkable that we are handing over people convicted under state and federal law private companies, and that these private companies can have remarkable power over an American citizen's life without the same sort of restraints often that the government faces. Government law enforcement agents are supposed to obey certain rules in terms of surveillance and investigation. They're supposed to get court orders for wiretapping. There are rules of evidence and requirements for probable cause. They're not always obeyed, but those laws are on the books. And corporate spies face many, many fewer restraints. In the state of Florida, for example, once a private investigator has a license, he or she can misrepresent themselves, can infiltrate and spy on people with impunity. In the Burger King case that I wrote about for the New York Times, it may have been illegal only because this young woman who ran a private investigation firm didn't have a license. So if you get a license, you can spy on people and lie to people and infiltrate their citizen groups. And I think this is something that Congress really needs to look into. And it's about privacy and invasion of privacy and protecting basic democratic freedoms. I mean, in the Florida case, we're talking about college students who are trying to help farm workers who are some of the poorest workers in the United States. There have been 7 cases prosecuted of slavery by the Justice Department in recent years in that area. Hundreds, if not thousands, of farm workers enslaved. And you ought to be able to protest against that sort of thing without having to worry about being spied upon. And that's where I hope Congress will really look into this during the next administration.
I take it, Eric Schlosser, when you testified recently to Congress, you essentially made this argument, did you?
No, the recent hearings were held by Senator Kennedy's Health, Labor, and Pensions, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, and that was looking into the terrible conditions of the farm workers. It was looking into the existence of slavery in the United States in the year 2008. These are poor migrants who are often in debt, kept in debt, and forced to work for free, and that was the subject of the hearing.
Well, just again, back to the idea of corporate spying, Eric Schlosser, it would seem to me that rent-a-cops, for example, these private security people who show up usually after the house has been robbed, but they're armed and dangerous, and usually they're the kind of people who don't qualify to join police forces. And my fear is that perhaps what's happening here in corporate America is when they hire these people, since they're so bottom line in their mentality, they may be hiring people cheap, you know, people that flunked spy school at the farm at the CIA or that weren't good enough to get into a police force. Are they getting bottom feeders?
With some of, in the Burger King case, this is a very intriguing private investigation firm where the owner doesn't have a license and one of the former subcontractors is convicted of a multiple murder. I mean, the Burger King case I wrote about in the New York Times sounds like something out of a Carl Hiaasen novel, a bizarre, crime thriller set in Florida. But with other companies, what disturbs me is how competent, sophisticated, and well-prepared their private security people are. I mean, Walmart's head of security was a former top official at the CIA. Again, some high-level Secret Service and defense intelligence agents are now in the private sector. And one of the reasons that this is so disturbing is the technologies that they now have available are very, very advanced. And the ways they can obtain information on people through the Internet, through all kinds of electronic surveillance is probably greater than we've ever had before. And that's why we need to deal with it now before we live in a surveillance state. And as you said at the beginning, there's been an enormous amount of publicity about the Patriot Act, about the threat to civil liberties that the government now poses to us, but much less attention has been paid to these private security firms and corporate power and the threat they pose to our ability to just speak out about things we don't like.
And Eric Schlosser, what is it exactly that these corporate CEOs and that make these decisions and create these their own spy agencies I take it, for example, in the food area that you're familiar with, having written Fast Food Nation. I guess what they're most afraid of is the public waking up. I mean, we have a peculiar situation in the United States where we're both stuffed and starved. You have both obesity and malnutrition at the same time, which is an extraordinary paradox. So occasionally you see footage from an abattoir of some terrible treatment of a downer cow, et cetera, that creates a furor. And then, you know, meat gets recalled. So is there, on the one hand, they're spending all this money on advertising to tell you to buy this stuff. But on the other hand, what they appear to be terrified of is that the American people wake up and find out the extent to which they're poisoning themselves.
Yeah. Well, I think it's actually very straightforward. This is about power. It's quite simple. And I'm not anti-corporate in any simplistic way at all. I mean, I was in the Soviet Union when there was a Soviet Union, and I believe in the private sector, but this is about what happens when you have concentrated power of any kind. And the psychology is no different for one of these big corporations as it would be for a big government agency. They don't want to be questioned, they don't want to be criticized, and they want their point of view, as they express it through their marketing, to prevail. So people who question their policies, their business practices, who criticize their policies and their business practices, are the ones who are going to be targeted. And that's exactly the same way that governments work when they don't like their critics. During the 1960s, the United States government had the COINTELPRO program that infiltrated a wide variety of groups. Martin Luther King was spied upon and harassed. During the 1930s, there were, huge efforts to infiltrate labor unions and disrupt labor unions. So this is about power that doesn't want to have to deal with criticism. It's really as simple as that. And we have, more concentrated economic power in this country than we've had in 100 years, since the 1890s, in the age of the trusts. We have two or three companies that essentially control each sector of the U.S. economy. And they don't like it when people disagree with their business practices. And the people who speak out are the people who have to worry. And one of the things that this does, which is terrible, is that all these activist groups and environmental groups, as soon as the spying is discovered, it creates mutual suspicion. It takes a lot of time to figure out who's a spy, who's not a spy, what's going on. And this is a very, very effective way of disrupting dissent. It's good to collect. It's a good way to collect information, but it's also a good way to mess around with these organizations who have to worry about their phones and their email and their garbage and who shows up at their office and whether it's a real activist or whether it's a plant. And it's a way, again, of disrupting any kind of criticism.
Well, just in closing, Eric Schlosser, you mentioned the Gilded Age and of course, William Jennings Bryan, who lost to McKinley, said at that time, after the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad decision was made, that enshrined a corporation as a person in law. And of course, there's no such person as Mr. General Motors. So there's no real accountability at the end of the day. And they've got all the protections of the 14th Amendment, but they don't really exist. And he warned at that time that the great challenge for the 20th century was to protect the God-made man from the man-made giant, the corporation. And that seems to be pretty prescient, wouldn't you say?
I think it was, but I think that, some of the problems that we had in the 1890s were dealt with. Teddy Roosevelt, a pro-business Republican president, spoke loudly and often about the dangers of concentrated economic power. It was the beginning of the trust-busting era, and, certainly we got a much more competitive and much more diverse economy in the 20th century than we had at the end of the 19th century. And what's tragic is how in the last 25 years, in many ways, we've had a return to the jungle, the sort of world that Upton Sinclair wrote about, in which, big companies have gotten bigger in the last 25 years, and there's been very little government effort to restrain them. So I'm optimistic. I think that, you know, there is, especially if citizens are aware of what's going on, there is a way to push back against this concentrated corporate power and not accept this sort of behavior. And I think companies that get caught in the act doing this sort of thing should be embarrassed and punished, and the message should be sent that this is not acceptable behavior in a democracy.
I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles today, Eric Schlosser.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Eric Schlosser, America's one of America's great investigative journalists. He's a winner of numerous awards, and he's now currently correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, and his first book, Fast Food Nation, was widely considered a modern classic. And he wrote an article recently in the New York Times entitled Burger with the Side of Spies. I'm now speaking with Ian Williams, who's written for newspapers and magazines around the world, including The Financial Times, The Guardian of London, and in which his work regularly appears. He's the UN correspondent for The Nation and for The Tribune, and the author of a number of books, including The United Nations for Beginners. And here we have a situation, Ian Williams, and I know you wrote about it in The Guardian, where the notion of bringing up this responsibility to protect resolution, which was adopted in 2005 at the UN World Summit by 150 member states, there's a lot of talk now of applying it to the situation in Myanmar, Burma, because of this thuggish regime, paranoid generals who have been looting the country now for the last 40 years, who are resisting international aid, and apparently perfectly happy to see their people, 200,000 of whom probably died, millions perhaps could die from disease and starvation as a consequence of their neglect. But isn't it also true, Ian Williams, that that George W. Bush has given intervention a bad name?
Well, that's precisely the problem that we came across with Darfur, is that after Iraq, the British certainly realized that much as they hoped that somebody else would do some strenuous action in Sudan to help Darfur, they realized that Britain and the U.S. had written themselves out the equation. It's very difficult to take the moral high ground. And, you know, the resolution that was passed, which basically reinterpreted the UN Charter to suggest that things that happened inside a country could be a threat to international peace and security, the worst thing that could possibly have happened to it was the Iraq invasion, because ever since then, we're really talking about excuses as far as many of the people in the world are concerned. And, you know, their attitude is that whatever, they mightn't agree with what the Burmese generals are doing, but where does it stop? If you allow people to intervene with them, then, you know, why shouldn't the U.S. intervene in India to stop the iniquities of the caste system? Or, you know, why shouldn't it just pick an excuse? Because every country has an excuse for intervention, because we threw away the international mechanisms. And I still think it's not without hope, because I think that China, despite the tragic earthquake, China is uniquely vulnerable because of the emphasis it's put on the Olympics. I really believe that discreet diplomacy on the Chinese would get them to... They're the only people with leverage on the Burmese generals, and I think that some discreet pressure on them, that their parade will get very seriously rained upon.
Well, you'd have to add, the Chinese, they've got quite a docket against them, if you will. They've got Darfur, they've got selling arms to Mugabe in Zimbabwe, who's oppressing his people and beating the hell out of the opposition, to the extent that the leader of the opposition can't even return to the country because he's under a death threat. Then you have the Burma situation. But it seems to translate to the Chinese, at least perhaps this is how the Chinese government's manipulating their own people, as an insult to China's pride. They're putting on a party for the world. And suddenly you're complaining about the Tibetans and the Sudanese and the Zimbabweans and now the Burmese. What's that got to do with us?
Well, the most upsetting point about it is, in fact, that the Chinese regime has been able to get the Chinese population fired up on a nationalist rant about this. And partly it is ineptitude. You know, it's interesting, you know, that it's quite true that the U.S. was quite prepared to condone and overlook disastrous ineptitude on the part of itself and its own allies, and to condemn it with others. And Burma is a sort of special case because the generals genuinely don't seem to care. They regard themselves as the embodiment of the nation. I mean, it's not just that they're selfish kleptocrats, although they are that as well. But the Burmese military genuinely believe themselves to be the incarnation of Burmese nationhood. You know, so they it's far more important that any aid that goes through comes via the generals than that people might starve if otherwise. So that makes them almost impervious to international pressure. But the military are funded because of basically the Chinese are looting Burmese national resources and paying for it. So it is the one vulnerable point, is one point where the Chinese really should be called to account. You know, if they, in some respects, they do behave as responsible world citizens, and it is just that they're quite right that a lot of the sort of criticisms verge on xenophobia. There was a piece by Simon Winchester in the New York Times, which I found just a total travesty. You know, as the Chinese are sort of locked in backwardness, and that's why they had so many people killed in the earthquake. You know, unlike, of course, here where we handled Katrina so well, and where bridges never fall down, and the infrastructure is so strong. You know, I was looking at it and thinking, no wonder the Chinese get rabidly nationalist when they read crap like this.
Well, I understand, though, Ian Williams, that the Burmese regime is extremely paranoid because they recognize somewhere, in spite of their thuggishness, they recognize that they brutalize their own people, that they're deeply unpopular, and that they were repudiated in the 1990 vote that elected the Aung San Suu Kyi, who they stuck in under house arrest as a result, that they've moved their capital north because they're afraid, and they built it like a fortress. And apparently, they were a bit paranoid about an American ship off the coast. So they may have absolute power, but they also are paranoid.
Yeah. Now, as I said before, I mean, you know, in a way, these people are like some of the conservative Republicans who consider themselves the embodiment of America, regardless of what the voters say. You know, they don't recognize the results if the vote goes against them. So the junta is in exactly the same position. They do not recognize, the nation is us. And, you know, anyone who says any different is obviously treacherous. It's fairly common in some ruling quarters to consider themselves to be purer representative of the nation than the actual nation itself, in terms of the people. So it does make them uniquely almost invulnerable to anything other than a full-scale military assault. And then this is really where the people who framed their whole concept of the responsibility to protect, the humanitarian intervention doctrine, were very, very careful in phrasing it. And the report, which was drawn up by the Canadian paid-for international commission, was very clear that this was a last resort option, because once you start interfering with sovereignty, then you get your Iraqs, you get your Czechoslovakias, you get your, you know, you get intervention in Kuwait from the Iraqi side. Because it is the bedrock principle of international relations that you do not interfere in other countries. So it can only be, the rule can only be broken in extreme circumstances. And one of the list of conditions they included was, apart from getting the sort of full legal authority from the United Nations, was also that you are very sure that whatever you do does not make the situation worse. So, you know, if you could think that one thing that could be worse than a flood and a famine and a plague, it could be a sort of military action fought across that terrain.
But isn't there a built-in restraint here? If you got the Security Council would be the forum at which the rules of the game were laid down. I mean, I know there's a lot of talk now coming from various quarters. The French foreign minister, of course, who's also the founder of Doctors Without Borders, he's spoken out in favor of this non-consensual intervention and this responsibility to protect resolution being invoked.
In principle, Bernard Kouchner is quite right, and he's been consistent on this. But In fact, it was the French who almost reinvented the doctrine of humanitarian intervention in response to Saddam Hussein trashing the Kurds at the end of the first Gulf War. So they've been fairly consistent in extolling the principle, even if pretty inconsistent in their application of it, like in the Balkans and in Rwanda, where they actually came in on the side of the people doing the killing more often than not. So there's room for cynicism all around here, and that's the real problem, is that there's very few people with pure hands. And if you took countries that you would trust, if you took, say, the Canadians and the Irish and the New Zealanders and the Jamaicans, people who sort of don't have a dog in the fight, apart from, you know, pure humanitarianism, the problem is they don't have the military resources to do anything. So you really are in this class stick, and I think...
Well, it's also
standing for public opinion on behalf of Kushner at home is probably more harmful. I mean, I think firm but strong words with the Chinese to pass on to the Burmese. And I don't know who you saw, but Lord Mark Malik Brown, the British minister today, said that the British would be quite prepared to funnel their aid behind an Asian team. You know, they'd be quite prepared to give aid to the Chinese to pass on to the Burmese if that was what it took to keep the Burmese happy. You know, so some people are as being a little more discreet and trying to, trying not to ruffle feathers unnecessarily.
To camouflage the notion of this sort of colonial white man's burden idea. But just in closing, Ian Williams, there is a pattern here, obviously, in the post-Cold War world. And, you know, the International Criminal Court has been set up, and the United States has at least the Bush administration has done everything to keep away from that regime. But it is odd in this world that the U.S. has intervened first under Bush Sr. to arrest one man down in Panama. They went to war against a country, killed a whole bunch of innocent people, to arrest one criminal in Iraq. They went to war twice and then invoked hideous sanctions against the people of Iraq. So there's an inherent dysfunction here, and we had this case of Milosevic that you mentioned in the Balkans, where we end up punishing the people and not the dictator. So there's clearly got to be some kind of regime where, when you have these dictators like these guys in Burma, there's got to be a way that you can arrest them and not punish the people.
You say there's got to be, but you're saying this in the sort of sense that, yes, everybody should be nice to each other.
Right.
Yes, everybody should be nice to each other, but is it feasible? And,
right.
You know, the responsibility to protect, it's there, it's on the statute books. And
right.
Like I sort of said at the time, it took it's been 3,000 years since somebody said, thou shalt not kill and thou shalt not commit adultery. And, you know, when I checked recently, neither of these sins was...
right. Well, we can put... I understand, but we put away a 14, 15-year-old boy down in South Central for shooting somebody, and yet these dictators can kill millions. So there is... I'm just trying to get we've run out of time, I'm sorry.
But, pressure is what we need. Some discreet pressure.
I thank you so much for joining us, Ian Williams.
Thanks, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Ian Williams. He's the UN correspondent for The Nation and The Tribune. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Lik Duan, the assistant producer, and Tamika Zoghi, the engineer today.